Jiu-jitsu. Jiu-jitsu is no joke. It takes years to master.
Martial arts are a vehicle for developing your human potential. And nothing in my life has ever put me in face with reality better than jiu-jitsu.
Training in BJJ offers a powerful lens through which to examine some primary human concerns: truth versus delusion, self-knowledge, ethics, and overcoming fear.
There's more philosophy in our mats than actually philosophy in any Ivy League school.
Welcome to Philosophy.
Hello, everybody.
And welcome to another episode of
Philosophy.
How are you, my friend?
I'm chilling like a villain.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm all good. Thank you. All good.
So today, I don't even know how to start this podcast because we might have a miscommunication situation
we might.
Here.
We right? might. We could always use the methodology that Coach uses, which is white belt, black belt.
Okay. So today we have white belt Ollie.
Hello.
And black belt Ollie.
Hi.
Hello.
Welcome to the podcast, black belt Ollie.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're going to start off by asking the same question we ask everyone on this podcast, which is, how did you get into jiu-jitsu?
I was actually thinking about that today in anticipation of this very podcast. I thought that could well be a likely question. In as nutshell a form as possible, 80s child put into karate three times by my mum, was watching on a Friday night, I think roughly when I was 12. You know, there was this sequence where you'd watch a show called Passengers and The Word, Beavis and Butthead, all these like series of great late night Channel 4 programs on a Friday night, and I'd watch it religiously. And one, I mean, like every single week, not, you know, sort of on a regular basis. And on this show, Passengers, so this was circa 1994, and they did an excerpt on Hoist Gracie, while I suppose like at the time that he was a sort of active UFC fighter. And of course, it caught my attention. I was pretty sort of interested by it. And then I started buying Black Belt magazine, and he had a column in it. And so I went out one day, I remember distinctly, 1995. At the time, I was like a sort of, I was a juvenile black belt in karate, complete martial arts obsessive, but sort of, you know, Bruce Lee fanatic, all the rest of it. Like, we a pretty common story, I'm sure, nothing unusual there. And I went out and bought a VHS copy of UFC 2. And I was, by that time, I was 13. And I watched it once, was completely entranced, and watched the whole thing a second time, possibly even a third time. And that was a very sort of formative moment of, you know, sort of having grown up on Jackie Chan, Bruce Lee, etc., which is still great and still have huge nostalgia for that stuff. Here was like seeing something for real, but also spectacular. So that's what got me into jiu-jitsu. And just back then, I was immediately just sort of absorbing, copying, trying to learn the moves. And then my first encounter with jiu-jitsu formally, again, so by this time it was 1996, and I had been asked by a family friend to go out to New York, to stay in New York, but actually to take part in a student film in New Jersey as part of the Tisch Film School of New York University. And one of my conditions was, yeah, great, but you've got to let me go and train at Craig Kukoc's Academy, which I did at age 13. I did a double session. I think it was quite expensive, you know, well, for me as a 13-year-old, and just was sort of in complete paradise. It was just like, it was 3 hours of just straight grappling with like fully grown men. The next day I could hardly walk at all. So anyway, that's it was a good thing.
I was going to ask you, like, at the age of 13, UFC 2, was there a lot of jiu-jitsu around?
Yeah, so by then, you mean by around, you mean in the...
Well, I mean, anyone wants to start jiu-jitsu today, they have, like, so much choice.
Of course, it's a completely different landscape, of course. Back then, it was a case of literally watching Hoist, Hicks and Henzo on various VHS tapes competing respectively in the UFC or early UFC, what was called the World Combat Championships for Henzo Gracie, and Hickson doing the World Valetudo Championship in Japan. And it was literally just all Gracie Jiu-Jitsu in action, just all these sort of VHSs which were passed around. And it was just a case of copying and then practicing this stuff with your friend in the park or on the mats at lunch hour at school, that kind of thing. And it's weird, like, if I could, you know, have my time again kind of thing, if I could go back in time, I would have made myself go and do judo, basically, like, in quite a serious way. I mean, if given that there was no jiu-jitsu at the time, but at the time, from the point of view of a 13-year-old into, you know, karate, kung fu, and then Hoyt Gracie. Like, judo had quite a kind of dry, conservative image, which is unfortunate, because, you know, that would have been a great, or, you know, a good way in, yeah. I think. But, you know, hey, you learn hindsight and so on.
So when did you, like, formally start training jiu-jitsu?
So actually I was thinking about this too. So I had a friend who I'm still very good friends with now, although he's since long lost touch with jiu-jitsu, although we, you know, he shares very good memories of it with me, a guy called Harry, Harry Dunn, who I was at school with, and Harry and I were on the swim team together. And Harry was interested in, you know, like, boxing and stuff, and he trained a bit of boxing, and he was very athletic. He was an elite level swimmer, whereas I was just a high school swimmer. And it was, by this time we were 14, and it was the summer holidays. When was it? This was either 96 or 97. I think 97. And Harry came round to mine every single day. This still wasn't the formal start of jiu-jitsu, but this was a very important step in my own progression. Harry came, so he was my first, like, really formal sort of dedicated training partner. So I basically, like, he became the guy I taught everything I knew to, and he was athletic and keen, and we trained every single day together. I mean, keep in mind, this was very, like, primitive stuff by today's standards. It's like, we weren't really doing anything in the way of takedowns. It was all just, like, very basic guard pass, mount, one or two sweeps, you know, an arm bar, you know, I think an arm triangle choke was about as sophisticated as things got.
And what was that like? Because I guess you had no one looking over your shoulder saying,
no, I mean,
good, bad.
We had tremendous fun. And yeah. The fact that he loved it, I was very grateful for. And it meant I had someone to train with. And he was strong and athletic and fit. And, you know, he still is a tough guy. So that was great. So, and then, it must have been the following year. It was the following year, 1998. And so we carried on doing this throughout the school year, just Harry and me. And then there was a guy who joined up with us called Prashan, who's a Sri Lankan guy, who's now works, he runs it. He's a doctor in somewhere in the rural Midwest of America, but he was also a very important part of our little circle. And he was from, like, a few years below as well. So he came to join us and we all trained together. The following year, we went to a place, also another important step, a very famous established British MMA fighter had put out an advertisement. And so this is very pre-internet in MAI, Martial Arts Illustrated, or it may have been Combat, but this is one of the, like, black and white, tatty, sort of traditional karate-focused, Bruce Lee-worshipping magazines. And James Zikic is his name. I bumped into him the other day, actually, in Chinatown. Anyway, he had a huge beard. And he sent a letter in just saying, I'm serious about MMA, I need training partners, please contact me at this address. So I wrote him a letter, you know, like, postcard letter, saying, yeah, I'll join you. And I, at the time,
how old
I was
are you?
15.
Okay, cool.
I was 15, James, I think, was...
You're living in London.
Yeah, in London. And so that was my introduction to the Queen Mother Sports Centre. So this became quite a sort of... And then there's another guy there called Dexter Casey, who was also a British MMA fighter, fought in Japan. I think he works in the city now. This is 1998. So I was 15, going on 16, 1998. And I joined, this was every Sunday, all these guys would meet and just, like, no gi, just open mat, just putting stuff together, sharing what we knew so far. So that wasn't quite jiu-jitsu, but it was the same world, you know. And then more formally, so that carried on for a while, and that was good. A good experience. You know, James Zikic went on to do quite serious things in the UFC, and, you know, he was very much like a sort of significant pioneering fighter in British MMA. And then there was a man called, I mean, other people will have told the same story, but a man called Chen, or I think his real name was Almir Itajahe de Moraes, and he was the first black belt in London who set up shop at the Budokai. And I went down and joined his academy with my friend Harry, who came for a bit, and we trained there. So again, that was still in 1998, and back then Lee Hasdell, who's also one of the sort of godfathers of British MMA, was putting on these amateur MMA shows up in Milton Keynes or sort of events, and we all went to compete in that lots, and I was training a lot then as a 16-year-old, and it was sort of, it was different to how things were jiu-jitsu wise, in that it was sort of like, you know, yellow belt, orange belt, etc., etc. Also met there, trained with, and got beaten by in the semi-finals of the first big UK BJJ tournament, Jude Samuel, who runs Urban Kings. Oh, and so I trained a lot with Jude Samuel. I first met Jude at this training circle at the Queen Mother Sports Centre with James Zickick and co. So yeah, so that was like a real sort of 1998, kind of like where things started in this country, which, you know, I was sort of happy to have been a part of.
Yeah, we had Coach on the other week. Yeah. And he was talking about similar kind of experience with Chen and the first competition. Did you know him back then? Is that how you met him?
So I first met Coach in, I think it was 2002. 2002, yes. So by then I was at university. I'd got my blue belt. I'd gone to Brazil immediately after my A-levels for 2 months. And that was an incredible experience, training twice a day in Rio. I mean, I can tell you about that in a second. So I first met Louise, first met Coach at the very beginning of what has gone on to become the Carlson Gracie School in London. And that was in the back room of a hotel in Earl's Court. Louise was also a blue belt then. I was blue belt, and we trained together lots then. Became quite friendly. He helped me prep for an MMA fight that I was doing back then, which actually got called off, but still. So got quite friendly with Louise there. And then I went abroad again. We went our separate ways, but then came back together in 2008 when I first joined LFF, when I come back from my second period of living in Japan.
And so, am I right in thinking he gave you your black belt?
Yes, so I got my black belt at LFF, yes.
So like from the moment you started training with the MMA fighter, and you met this other group of people who were also like into jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
When did it become sort of formal enough for you to be like, I am a white belt, and then have that process?
So I'd been really by the time I got my blue belt, which was when I was 18 in Brazil, after the 2 months training in Brasil. So I got my blue belt at the Nova Geração Academy, and it's kind of cool that we're now part of Fight Sports, which is under Cyborg. And Cyborg got his black belt from Francisco Albuquerque, or Toco, who gave me my blue belt and my purple belt.
Very sick.
When I went back a second time to Brazil when I was 21. But by the time I got my blue belt, I was already quite experienced as a white belt. So from jiu-jitsu first entering my kind of consciousness when I was 13 in 1995 with the VHS UFC 2, to just sort of obsessively doing the best I could to learn it and practice during my teens. And like wearing different colored belts at Chen's club. There's this a step between those 2 points, which is important to fill in. But so I turned up in Brazil as a white belt, training twice a day for 2 months, but already quite experienced. I mean, I'd had 5 years of sort of inconsistent experience before that. Not in the best of circles, but, you know, very enthusiastic, but without proper coaching. Which is how I think it started for a lot of guys. I think, mental blank, famous Norwegian MMA fighter. They all describe, like, trips to London, to HMV and Virgin Megastore, buying these, like, tapes back in the 90s and sort of, like, training with their friends. So it's a not uncommon beginning. But then my first, like, even though Chen at the Budokai was a legit black belt, quite a bit older, and he taught quite a sort of, by today's standards, almost a kind of classical, slightly Aikido-y style of BJJ, if that's possible to imagine. One day a guy walked into his club, who still, I believe, teaches in London. I think he had a club up in Edmonton, a guy called Arlen Siqueira. And Arlen's at the time was a young brown belt, and walked into this big club full of British white and, you know, yellow, orange belts, etc., etc. And just sort of, you know, as you'd expect, just
casually went about just destroying all of us. I was like, wow. And he was like, I just like, just passed your guard, like it was nothing at all. And, da, da, da. And I was like, wow. That was my first, like, at that time I'd have been, I guess, 16. That was my first encounter with, like, you know, sort of the power. You know, I'd seen it on screen, but that was my first, like, encounter, because Chen didn't train with us. I mean, he didn't spar with us. That was my first, like, physical encounter with, like, you know, the power of jiu-jitsu. It was like, whoa, this guy's got sort of superpowers kind of thing. Just, like, the ease with which he did anything he wanted without seeming very tired. And so he set up a club briefly. Again, this was 1998 to 99. And I went to train. That was up in Wood Green in a sort of big warehouse with, like, various churches, you know, like rooms with people worshipping and stuff, and he had his own space to do jiu-jitsu. So it was very early days, and that was an incredibly good experience, just in terms of, like just being taught solid, like, this is how you should go about passing guard, this is what to focus on, the you know, like, it's like learning fundamentals and stringing it all together kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, you guys, like, training at a really good established club, going from, like, white to blue belt with the things you're being taught now, if you went back in time and trained at Arlen's club, it wouldn't have seemed that big a deal, because you've had such a good beginning in terms of, like, what you're fed from the start. Whereas to us at the time, it was like, whoa, this is the stuff, you know?
It's making me feel grateful.
I was thinking about that. Like, last time I was telling, a lot of times when I go back home to Mozambique, and my friends are like, how many black belts do you have in your class? It's like sometimes three. They're like, whoa.
Yeah. Bro, like, even when I go back to the Cotswolds, I remember sitting around, like, chatting with some guys, and they were like, so do you get coached by a black belt? And I was like, yeah. And I was like, we've got like three or four there in London. And they were like, no way. Exactly. Like, even in the UK, you do get pockets like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's I guess, like, we just got acclimatized. So this is all we know, right?
Yeah. We are spoiled. So you go to Brazil. And which, I guess, what was that like?
Incredibly positive, happy. I mean, both in terms of the jiu-jitsu, but also as an experience. Like, my first time abroad by myself, you know, other than, like, you know, like, trips with school to France and that kind of thing. And having spent my childhood in Canada, here and there, it was my first. So I went with a close friend of mine at the time, and Just we stayed. Actually, it was the way it all came about was also interesting. My older half brother and sister at the time lived in their mum's place in Camden, and they had a spare room, which they let out to this Brazilian girl called Ana Fialho. And they were talking to her about Brazil, and they were like, "Oh yeah, my half brother is into Brazilian jiu-jitsu." She's like, "Oh wow, me too." And so it was like, "Wow." And so they were telling me, "Ollie, we've got this tenant who's into jiu-jitsu," but they didn't know much about it beyond that. So I came around and I met this girl, Anna, a small sort of athletic girl who's gone on to become I think she's a pediatrician now in Brazil. So she's a very serious doctor. She's from a family of doctors. Her mum's a doctor, but at the time she was the blue belt champion of Rio. And she was from Nova Geração, and she was a tiny girl. And I was a lot bigger than her, but it was like, oh my God. So we just started training immediately together. And just, you know, I was like, wow, she knows jiu-jitsu. This is incredible. And obviously I was a lot bigger than her, but, like, it was just incredible, like, meeting someone again in London at that time. So this was 1990. No, by now this was 2000. So I was 17 years old. And we just started, like, training in my brother's living room. Not hard sparring, but just, you know, like, flow rolling and just having tons of fun and stuff. And I think she'd lost touch with jiu-jitsu. It was something she'd done during her teens, but quite seriously. And she invited me to come and stay with her family. So we both stayed with her. I'm incredibly grateful to them. You know, just like you meet people in life and they extend you, you know, just incredible generosity. And I stayed with her family for 2 months in Rio and trained at her club. At the time, you know, I've been researching lots of different clubs in Rio, places to maybe train. And she was just like, no, why are you bothering with that? Just come and train at my club. I was like, oh yeah, of course. And it was just around, like, just across the road from where she lived. I guess, like, it's close, the same distance from here to Fight Factory. And so it was her club, and I went and trained with her at her club. And just the club itself, Nova Geração, which has since expanded, I think it's now based in, like, Florida. I'm not sure exactly, but Toko, who was the professor, he... he's now moved to Florida. But anyway, at the time, as a place to train, it was incredibly good. It was a very, very, like, didn't at the time, and now it eventually they made one or two MMA fighters, but that wasn't the focus. It was just they were a very good, like, team-based jiu-jitsu club. Kids going throughout every rank, you know, and loads of kids from the local community, kids from the favela came as well. And so then I went back there a second time when I was 21, this time by myself, and trained again, which is where I got my purple belt.
Nice.
After a year's training in Canada, which was also great.
I mean, I'm guessing there was a big standard gap between going to Brazil and what was going on in London.
Yeah, for sure. But you'd be surprised though, because how to put it?
Because my view of Brazil is like the holy ground of of like jiu-jitsu.
Yes and no, but the thing is how to explain this. In Brazil or in Japan, for example, there's people move through the grades. It depends on individual cases, but like people would move through the grades more steadily, and you'd have champions at every level or active competitors at every level, and also people maybe not pushing it as hard at every level but still moving through the ranks. Whereas by the time 2002 to 2003, by then I was part of a club which was actually like contained a lot of the roots, as in terms of the people, for what went on to become LFF, which was Roger Brookings' club, which was part of Alianza. Roger Brooking, an incredibly important teacher for me. And at the time, he ran this club at the Seymour Leisure Centre near Baker Street, which was just this sort of sea of like very strong white, blue, one or two purple belts. But even then, they'd probably come from different clubs. And so it was just... And the same in Canada. I trained under Firas Zahabi's older brother, Ahmed Zahabi, in Montreal for a year. He was a purple belt.
Nice.
And he got his purple belt from Wagner Fabiano, part of Novo Unau. So as you can tell, I've kind of, you know, just through having lived in lots of different countries, trained here and there, I suppose, from one point of view, people might, you know, or by whichever of today's standards, it might be considered slightly crianchi-ish. Whereas for me, it was just like, you know, you go here, train there, go there, train there. And so hence why it's cool now being part of fight sports, because it's kind of, for me, come full circle.
Yeah, with that is Toko, cool. Yeah.
Albuquerque. But sorry, just the point about Montreal I was about to say is that, again, that was like a big club of like very athletic Canadian blue belts, like big Canadian guys who'd come from Canadian football or hockey, and they were like big into jiu-jitsu. But, you know, whereas in Brazil, of course, yeah, there were incredibly good, talented elite champions, but also like a lot of, you know, more sort of leisurely kind of guys, just sort of, you know, like, so yeah, it's kind of hard to generalize. And then, so hence when I remember when I went back as a blue belt, I was 21, still a blue belt, back to Nova Geração. Like, it was, in the class, there were sort of incredibly tough, challenging guys, but also, you know, like, you also spar certain brown belts and stuff and think, oh, it wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
how to phrase that. Diplomatically, but yeah,
they were going easier on you all.
Anyway, yeah, no, so no. I mean, the I think jiu-jitsu, just a point more generally about the grades and the levels and so on, which is a whole other topic of which I've got lots of opinions. But is that while it's like, you know, like a BJJ purple belt or brown belt or black belt or whatever, it's like a sort of a lot of time and effort goes into that compared to like its equivalent in like, I don't know, Aikido or Karate or Taekwondo. It's very hard. Yeah, sorry, the point I wanted to make. Found my thought. It's hard to find uniformity sort of between clubs and around the world, even from club to club in any given city.
Yeah.
But even so, I think like any legit, like, you know, blue, purple, and up is going to be, you know, extremely good standard.
Yeah. To add The majority of people that listen to this do jiu-jitsu, but for those that don't, to add context, the normal time to the average time to get a black belt can be anything from like 8 to 12 years, somewhere around that kind of ballpark, potentially longer, and it can take say 3 to 5 years to get a blue belt, as opposed to karate, I guess, which can take
exactly 5. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it really depends, because I mean, some karate schools, I guess, are very commercial. I mean, maybe a better comparison is judo, because judo, like, to get a black belt in judo, especially under the British system, you need to like actually compete for it. You have to do the lineup and so on. But up until the lineup, it's just like you learn, perform. It's more of a sort of bureaucratic process, which has its pros and cons. I think it's quite a good system in some ways, because you know you kind of learn stuff and then you get to a certain level. It's just a sort of benchmark. Whereas in BJJ, it's like things become more of a sort of significant achievement, and it's kind of simultaneously the most conservative and informal grading system. Conservative because the standards are very high, but informal because it's entirely at the instructor's discretion.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean, versus a sort of open bureaucracy where you know, you buy a license, you pitch up, you learn the pattern, you know, you serve the time. So it's just different. But I think it's definitely something to be proud of, I think, like moving through jiu-jitsu.
I think as well, like it opens up a lot of judgment from others that are like, oh, he's not a blue belt, or he's not a purple.
It's unfortunate, especially I hate seeing people online on YouTube slagging off other people who are, unless the person's an out and out actual fraud. If the person's like a legit black belt, but maybe they're having a bad day or whatever it is, or they're just in a tough match. And people go, oh, that guy's not a black belt. It's like, who the hell are they to know what that person's been through, that their own personal journey and struggle to reach that point? And I hate seeing that. But I guess that's just a sort of case of armchair warriors. And you see that.
I saw one. I think it might have been in Canada. And it was a blue belt, and a pro wrestler came and sparred with him.
Do you mean pro wrestler as in like high level amateur wrestler, or do you mean like pro wrestler as in haystacks kind of?
No, the way I remember it being phrased on the video was that he was like, let's just say like a D1 wrestler.
Okay, yeah, so a high level wrestler, right?
High level wrestler.
Yeah, right, fine.
And there was
experienced strong wrestler.
Exactly. Hard, yeah. And there was the blue belt jiu-jitsu guy. The wrestler went through him.
Yeah, I mean.
And people were like, oh my God, does he not know how to sport? He's not doing this. It's like, fair play. He just went and sparred with this guy.
The thing about jiu-jitsu is it's such a broad range of. I mean, part of what I love and sometimes get annoyed about jiu-jitsu is it's such a broad range. Sure, it's focused on groundwork, but within jiu-jitsu is equally contained any amount of stand-up wrestling, any amount of stand-up judo. Yeah. It's such a broad palette, or canvas, rather, compared to something which is necessarily narrower, like wrestling, whichever style of wrestling, especially like Greco-Roman wrestling, or even freestyle wrestling, or judo, which, I mean, judo can also be, in theory, just as broad an array of stuff as jiu-jitsu. But in practice, judo tends to be more of a sort of stand-up specialism with some ground. And people could say, oh, the same is true of jiu-jitsu the other way around. It's like an ocean of groundwork with like some stand up depending on the person's preference or experience. But I mean, ideally, I think that's sort of a prototype. Or if I were to form jiu-jitsu fighters as a coach, I'd want them to really have a good stand up element, because I think it just really reinforces the ground game. I mean, you could say ideally, yeah, you'd like to be good at this and that, but in practice, people tend to specialize in jiu-jitsu. It's groundwork focused, sure. But I think like the more you can develop the stand-up, the better it is for the ground.
Well, I mean, the fight's starting on your feet, right?
Exactly. And it's a shame to have such a good ground arsenal without being able to bring it there. Yeah. You know?
Your grace is quite interesting, because you didn't start necessarily with such a... Maybe you had that... You were exposed to like, oh, I'm training with an MMA fighter here and there.
Yeah.
And as your journey went along, you did other things.
Yes, so... Right, exactly. So... I first got into wrestling properly, other than having experienced it a bit here and there in Canada as a child. That was a long time before. So I first got into property when I was like 17 in London. But that was only briefly. There was a club called LAW, London Amateur Wrestlers, that operated out of Kingsway College, which is now Kingsway Westminster, but at their campus in King's Cross, under a guy called Jack Fong. And that was a good experience, but it was only when I was 20, I then decided to seriously get into wrestling because of MMA. Because and the hook in, of course, I was aware of wrestling, you know, like Dan Severn and these various guys that the Gracies were up against. But back then it was like jiu-jitsu was the cooler, sexier thing. And wrestling was this kind of like gym teacher, you know, big guy with a mustache, kind of like slightly not, it wasn't the most appealing, it wasn't very attractive. Like it just seemed, you know, this image of like, and it was only actually the hook for me that really got me into wrestling was watching Japanese MMA. Shooto, so obviously Sakuraba was a sort of very developed college wrestler, and that, you know, if you watch his takedowns, his single legs and so on, that's straight freestyle wrestling, and it's effective. Like you watch his match against Vitor Belfort, and Vitor, I think it was a draw, but Vitor Belfort's a terrifying guy, and Sakuraba was just sort of taking him down with ease, and that was pure technique. So it was also watching Shooto and Uno Kowluna, who wasn't even a very high level freestyle wrestler, but he did a solid period of freestyle wrestling in high school, and that really went on to sort of form the basis of his MMA game. So just point being that then I, despite like jiu-jitsu being for me the really the sort of the central thing or the common thread or the thing that I love and hope to keep doing when I'm a lot older, because it's, you know, it's basically horizontal, so it's less impact than you know, doing, obviously, than doing like a striking, like a full contact striking style, or even serious judo or wrestling. Despite that being the thing that I'd love to, you know, keep doing on and into the future, I decided when I was 19, 20 that wrestling was like a really, really important thing to really dive deep into. Both, and it became really fun in like for its own sake, but also as a sort of way of better appreciating aspects of jiu-jitsu. I think was sort of came clearer with wrestling, I think, for sure. It's like, so yeah, I mean, to people doing jiu-jitsu out there, like jiu-jitsu can continue to be your first love, but any time spent wrestling is not at all wasted. It's really, really, really beneficial, basically.
Why do you think that is?
I mean, beyond all the sort of, you know, obvious points which anyone, you know, like a learning takedowns, the fence, this, that, and the other, just think for a second about, like, think of the guard position and think of the half guard position and think of basically what a sweep is. A sweep is, in a sense, structurally, it's like starting a takedown from your back. It's like an upside down takedown. So if you think about what wrestling is like the sort of art of takedowns and other stuff too. But it's got such a narrow focus on taking someone from their feet down to their back or down to the ground. And often you watch these matches of high level jiu-jitsu guys initiating, who aren't wrestlers or who haven't had any wrestling experience, and they're initiating a sweep from like the half guard. And they almost get there, they get the leg, they get up, they bring it up, but then the guy on top just like squashes them back down again. And I think, oh God, if only that were a wrestler in that same position, he'd certainly finish that. So structurally, at the heart of like kind of top down, you know, up down, wrestling sort of takes a very significant part of what's happening structurally, mechanically in jiu-jitsu, and really, really refines it, fine-tunes it, etc.
A lot of the guys that competed at last year's ADCC,
yes,
unanimously say that wrestling has to be like a key part of your game in terms of even just like the hand fight and the grip fight. And
I mean, exactly. A good analogy is Thai boxers training straight boxing in order to better refine their defense, their combinations, their hand combinations, and so on. There's just like, take another position in jiu-jitsu of like a front headlock, where a jiu-jitsu person might just go for a guillotine, fail to get the guillotine, then they've lost position. Whereas front headlock to go behind in wrestling is a really, really bread and butter position, both defensively and offensively. It takes up a significant percentage of training in wrestling is done from that front headlock position. Now you transpose that to a jiu-jitsu position and it's really, really useful. And that's neither a takedown, well, it's kind of takedown defense, but it's not immediately. There's a lot of little details there, which through training wrestling, you then bring them back into jiu-jitsu. And so this is what I mean about jiu-jitsu being so broad and being both its sort of appeal and kind of, it's a kind of hindrance for some people that because it's so broad, it's hard to not only to learn everything but to be good at everything. And so by doing, by going away and doing a bit of wrestling, you can then sort of come back in and import these really useful positions into certain jiu-jitsu positions. Aside from the obvious, which is takedowns and takedown defense, I'm saying you'll be surprised at how it can help you sweep people and how it can help you take the back from the front headlock, as opposed to just going for a guillotine or trying to get the back, but you do it too quickly, you rush, you fail to get it. Like wrestling methodically break down that position from, it's called a front headlock, but it's also like a head and arm position. So you're controlling the chin and the elbow.
We're getting rambling. No.
One thing that's quite interesting, it's like up to this point in the story, you're still like 21.
I was thinking this. You know what I mean?
It's like, I'm thinking, okay, you're in high school.
And how old are the guys you were training MMA with?
I said back that you mean at the James Zicker concert?
Yeah.
I guess they were in the early 20s maybe at the time. I was about 15.
Iki, what were you doing when you were 15, 16?
What was I doing? It's like, I think the other thing is also like, this is kind of like, because it's not like you're part of a team, like a swimming pool team, where, sort of like someone is actually...
Yeah, it was very, how to put it, very, what's the word? Like, not grassroots, but yeah, it felt like we were sort of kind of pioneering something.
There at the beginning, at least.
Yeah, they're at the beginning of a scene, which then sort of goes on. But looking back, even though at the time, I remember sort of as a teenager feeling frustrated that I was, thinking about like, I'd love to go to like California or Brazil or Japan or wherever all the sort of good jiu-jitsu is. And yet looking back on it, given the sort of the relative popularity of combat sports in this country, in the UK, like you look at boxing and there's quite a history of judo, and then going way further back, wrestling's persisted even though it's very minority in this country, but done to quite a high standard by those who do it here. It's not surprising with hindsight that MMA and jiu-jitsu should have eventually taken hold. And even like the martial arts scene has always been pretty big here in the UK, and like karate and taekwondo, whatever else.
But do you think that was like part of your personality as well, like sort of like that almost like, because it's part the excitement of I found gold, and also I mean the curiosity to keep on learning. And
yeah, I mean, I suppose it's a familiar pattern, but to any serious martial artist, the sort of appeal of BJJ and then more broadly MMA is pretty, it's clear to see why the sort of empirical truth of it, by which I mean like to some people. And there's nothing wrong with this, but you look at like I, if you think in terms of combat sports, you've got what I like to consider like that which is very heavily entrenched in theory, versus that which is sort of demonstrable in terms of its applicability. So on the theory side, it takes a lot of like of slack, but Aikido or at the very extreme level, like Tai Chi or even like Shorinji Kenpo, these styles which are very A does this, B does that. It's sort of these prearranged patterns versus stuff like boxing, wrestling, full contact karate, judo, etc., where you train to the capacity to throw someone or to knock them out or to pin them to the ground is just as as demonstrable as is someone's pace running over the 100 meters or something, or someone's capacity to throw the javelin X distance. So it's that appeal, it's that sort of that objectivity, I think, is very appealing. And yet, and that's always existed in these separate Olympic styles, which maybe have gone on to, you know, which was very far away from the sort of Jackie Chan, Bruce Lee exotic appeal in like the martial arts world. So I think what jiu-jitsu's done, just looking back over the last 30-40 years, is it's kind of brought the sort of slightly fantastical martial arts world into contact with the world of athletic applicability. And people, again, there's people who are talking about, you know, there's sort of the tiger's claw sort of, oh, I would rip off his face with the tiger's claw. Like, there's guys who really seek refuge in that kind of hypothetical stuff. What was my point? it's that really, I guess, the achievement of the Gracie family and the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is having sort of brought the applicable stuff into contact with the sort of with the fantasy world of martial arts, and it brought them both together into sort of, so it's brought the sort of the fantasy crowd into contact with reality.
Yeah.
I guess is my long-winded point.
I think that's what you're saying.
But it's interesting just seeing it over the course of like many years, and so that's I think, and that's quite a significant thing.
Yeah.
I mean, in the world of martial arts that you see in the films versus the martial arts that win you UFC fights. In many ways, like jiu-jitsu works. You can't argue too much against that.
Right, exactly. And even though things have moved on since the sort of, you know, as everyone's aware, since the sort of early days of the Hoist Gracie template, I suppose, you know, in terms of like more focus on striking and like wrestling details and so on, it's you know, people are still using jiu-jitsu to succeed at. In MMA, I mean, even if you look at someone, I suppose, like a Khabib, who's not formally a jiu-jitsu fighter, he's still, you know, it's that same... I mean, well, he won his last fight.
I was going to say, got to try him. Got to try him, right?
Exactly.
Good for him.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. And do you find, like, one thing that has always fascinated me about training with you, it's actually... outside of training, we'll be in the changing room, and that is just like a random conversation that ranges from jiu-jitsu to, oh yeah, yeah, like I speak Japanese, and oh yeah, yeah, I speak Portuguese.
Well,
it's like, in part, that is also very related to to jiu-jitsu, in the sense that it is a skill. We are learning something, and there are growing pains in this learning process, right?
Yeah, I mean, again, that's another thing I'm grateful for with the, I guess, the martial arts world. I mean, you know, beyond sort of certain platitudes of it bringing me into contact with different cultures, be it Brazilian or Japanese for me in my case, especially is, languages, I guess, as someone brought up as a sort of as an Anglophone speaker, it's always been extremely appealing to me, just that thing of being able to language as a sort of like form of software which you're adding to your brain, the same way you are a martial art to your body and brain. So yeah, that thing of sort of, you know, extending or refining the self, I suppose. And yeah, just so with Japanese, like, I'd been into Japanese or Eastern culture as a child and adolescent, and then really, because of the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu thing, lost touch with it during my teens when the focus was on Brazil and that was the excitement. And then wanting to, when I was focusing on competing in MMA, that took me back to Japan immediately after university, where I went for about a year. Then went back again for like another 2 years. Initially was, just probably learn some Japanese to be able to train with the guys and stuff. And then that became a real sort of obsession with Japanese fiction, Japanese literature, Japanese culture. And then necessarily Japanese language, which then, and now that's like my work currently. It's something it's brought me into contact with, and I definitely I recommend people to try and learn Portuguese, you know, try and learn Japanese, I don't know, try and learn even like Farsi, you know, go train in Iran, you know, for wrestling. There's tons of just to round out what might sound like a slightly sort of tawdry point, but just yeah, I think there's a definite which I suppose people don't take enough advantage of, but that link between both the martial art being a window into then culture and necessarily language as the source of passport into that culture, way in which to penetrate it, really by whichever means.
I mean, it is the one place on the mats where you just see everyone from all walks of life, like culturally, religiously, even just like the type of person they are, their jobs. It brings everyone together in almost like a leveling playing field as well.
Yeah, definitely. It's what's been very cool about also for me about LFF is that it's sort of become a kind of, not, I don't quite want to say a gentleman's club, because that sounds sort of like a bit elitist or sort of
we are terrifying. Open to everyone.
But again, like you're on the mats, everyone's wearing the same gear and sort of just about speaking the same language. And then you get to know people and it's like, oh, you're involved in this war. And you meet people sort of who might be connected to your vocation off the mats. And that's a really, that to me, I mean, having now been myself at LFF, it's coming up 12 years or so. It's been a real, a great sort of way to incidentally meet people, you know, via the sport that you share in common. And then, yeah, it's for sure that's a real positive beyond people just, you know, those poor souls just there in the gym on the treadmill by themselves, solipsistically plodding away.
How do you find, like, especially like with the part of learning, right?
Yep.
I mean, because learning a new language as an adult, I don't know if it's hard or if it's just scary, because it's literally like, it's kind of similar to actually facing to martial arts in a sense of like, oh, I'm going to learn how to fight.
Well, I genuinely think it's the latter. I think it's people think, I'll be sure it's not easy. Like anything worthwhile isn't easy, but I think people overestimate the difficulty and learning a new language. It's literally just a case of, it's getting over that sort of hesitance and just making it a daily thing, I suppose. Like, I don't know, losing weight or improving your flexibility, but on a kind of long term. I mean, how did you find it as a native Portuguese speaker? Was English a part of your life from the beginning? Because you speak completely fluent English, or was it something that you got into later on?
No, I got in it because of rap music.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
cool.
And movies. It's nice. Like,
but that's the perfect hook. I mean, yeah, that's the perfect key, because if it's just a dry textbook thing, you know, even if you think, oh, I should do this, that's not going to take you very far. But it's like music, be it rap music or movies, that's like, well, I guess English is the global kind of language, so you're going to get exposure to it, but having a way in is so important.
Yeah, I mean, and that was what I was finding interesting when you were talking about how, because you're like 13, and I mean, I'm imagining watching UFC at 13 and like repeating this tape, and it's like, of course you want to do it, you want to learn, you'll go out of your way, but I'm not so sure if it's like a very rational way of like, you know what I should do this weekend? I should go train. Or if it's just like,
you're right. But I heard someone talking the other day about you can't help what you're interested in.
Yeah.
And about that there might be something, you might respect something from a distance. Like, for example, my father's a very successful architect, quite established architect. And people have often asked me, oh, why didn't you follow him into architecture? It's something that I really appreciate. I like good architecture. I respect it from a distance. And likewise art. So he always put a huge focus on us as children into drawing and art. And it's something I did all throughout my childhood. And by any accounts, I got quite good at it as a child and right up till I was 16. But I just wasn't very interested in it as against, like, say, fiction or writing, which to me has always been incredibly sort of compelling. Likewise, martial arts, or like I was saying before, learning a language as just sort of this, a bit like, again, not wanting to overuse the cliche of it being a superpower, but like this sort of very real world skill, but which is also so abstract and is just part of your mind, essentially, which you're sort of, you've got it imprinted upon your mind. What was my point? About interest. And so this thing of like being, you know, how people are sort of, I don't know, some people are into shopping and some people are into, sorry, I like it being something sort of not something a bit superficial, but some people are deeply into like programming or, I don't know, investments. Another one for me, like I've sort of had some exposure to that through work, but it's not the most interesting thing for me. And yet, so it's funny how interest, as you're saying, Ike, like it's something that sort of connects, I suppose, fundamentally to your personality at some certain level, and you sort of follow your interests. The expression is like follow your heart, but I mean, I suppose, and some interests, we like to drink beer or get stoned or whatever it might be, and these aren't interests; these are sort of like, fun things to do. But I suppose, yeah.
Even in drinking beer, there are some people they're like actually interested. You find that he knows the different kind of beers.
Right. Yeah.
And I was wondering, like, now, okay, we had like, I don't know, about 9 months off of training, pretty much.
Yeah. Right.
There are a lot of people that they were probably making progress, like feeling like, oh yeah, like I know how to retain my guard. And for this 9 months, they're probably like doing YouTube workouts at home.
Yeah.
Or, you know, just like doing push-ups and going to the park for runs.
Yes.
2021 comes back and it's like, okay, I'm back on the mats now. It's like, it can be very frustrating.
Absence, making the heart grow fonder, hopefully.
Yeah, making the comeback and even just alone, without the comeback, it's already, sometimes it's already like very difficult to even know what's going on. And with your experience with learning jujitsu specifically, what would you advise?
It's fascinating again, the kind of the learning. There's a to start with a sort of relevant cliche, but always keeping a student's mindset is sort of a, you know, you've probably heard that before, but it's a very, very, very serious point. And to kind of keep a, you know, to be happy with your progress, or proud of it, and at the same time constantly self-critical in terms of thinking about where you could be doing better. For my own game in jiu-jitsu, well, one area that I've never really put enough effort into and always sort of want to try and put more into is my submission game, but you know, I've sort of got a kind of adequate, you know, I've got a working knowledge and do some things quite well. But one thing, in sort of between brown to black belt, something, and so for me, from purple to brown, I was training incredibly hard, taking it very seriously. And then brown to black belt, the first few years of that, I was actually focusing more on wrestling, both coaching and competing in wrestling. But then I was sort of, you know, I came back around to jiu-jitsu. So, you know, it's a sort of constant. And for me, the just a specific thing, the capacity to invert and really improve guard retention and thinking about that as a skill. So not just one single technique, but the idea of kind of keeping important elements to guard retention and watching people who are very good at doing that and trying to work out how to do it, increasing flexibility to do that. And then, so even if you're in a bad round or you're not doing so well in the particular round, you can sort of fall back on your guard, not let it get past, and sort of at least, you know, forcing something like a draw is better than just being outright beaten. What was the point about learning and just keeping an active mind insofar as jiu-jitsu is made up of any number of particular individual isolated techniques, which you can't look at in isolation. It's always sort of keeping in mind this overview or this bigger picture, and seeing how that is composed of these individual techniques, but how, you know, the sort of, so you're keeping in mind your sort of overall game, which is composed of these individual parts. And being self-aware.
I don't feel like you need to learn any more submissions, though.
I was like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, I feel like you got enough of them.
But really, it's I guess it's part of self-awareness, right? It's like we're seeing from the outside.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, especially with nowadays, you get these real, these leg lock experts, and that's become a sort of very sort of niche, niche specialism, in the sense that jiu-jitsu, as against I think other more sort of previously established styles, is really sort of growing organically, and that's a big part of its appeal. And yet for me, just sort of having originally sort of built my jiu-jitsu game around a sort of MMA focus with a real emphasis on wrestling, to me I've always really liked or thrived on the positional side of it. So taking the back, passing the guard, takedowns, sweeps, to then be in a position to sort of hit someone well in an MMA match, or avoid being hit or smashed up, as the case may have been in some fights I lost. But so now, like, I mean, this year with a few guys from the club, we put a real focus on, like, trying to learn the saddle and, like, really trying to learn leg attacks, and not even necessarily to be that good at it, because I don't know temperamentally, like, there's some people who are really amazingly good at that stuff, but the more you can, like, learn about it, you know, if at best you can hopefully avoid it, you know, sort of be better at defending against it.
I think it's here to stay, right?
Like, oh yeah, no, for sure.
Part of the whole, like, Danaher Death Squad is their game, and it's been devastating.
Exactly, and then you see these geniuses like Ryan Hall, who will then pull it off in MMA and that kind of thing.
So, BJ Penn.
Exactly. So, you know, to the people say, oh, it's just a grappling thing. It's like, you know, that's not entirely true. When you see people who just manage to put it off in MMA, at the same time, I'd still, you know, sort of would urge people to really learn the positional game first, and then to then, you know, not so much first, but to maybe prioritize that as a sort of important basic building block, and then you can add to that.
Definitely.
It's quite interesting. I would never mention a name if someone told me, like, Philip. he focused so much on leg locks for a long time that now he's gotten so good that he says, yeah, like, I now find that I struggle as a blue belt to pass guard.
Yeah, what's interesting, like, yeah, that. I trained with, I remember I went up to visit a friend of mine in the north of Japan, guy who actually now lives in London, a guy called Masaya Doi. He lived in London a long time ago, was part of Carlson Gracie. And I went up to train with him and a bunch of his guys in the north of Japan. I was a purple brown belt at the time. And this guy came along. I don't know his name at all, but he was this Japanese guy from, I think, even out of town. And he comes specially to train with us. And it was incredible. It was very eye-opening. It was a learning experience for me. I mean, the fact that I got tapped out loads. Basically, like, I'd pass his guard. I took his back. I was just all over him positionally. But just sort of literally out of nowhere, he just, like, weave in and find these leg entries and just tap me out, like, again and again. And it was very, at the time, frustrating, but also pretty eye-opening. It's weird. And then you can also spar the same person on a different day and manage to just shut them down, get their back, clamp down. They don't get anywhere near your legs. So, yeah, it's a back and forth, I think.
How was your experience during competition? Did you compete? Because I'm imagining you competed as a jiu-jitsu fighter and also as an MMA fighter.
Yeah.
And a judoka.
Only a little bit for my university, and then a bit just in, like, special, like, judo groundwork competitions. I look back on my time competing. I suppose across quite a breadth of, I had 8 professional MMA fights, bouts, of which I won 5, lost 3. Only 7 of those are recorded on Sherdog. One just didn't get put up, which is a fight that I won, by the way, up in Newcastle, or actually in a little place called Bedlington. And then I tried to count it once, like a long time ago, but hundreds of matches across BJJ, freestyle wrestling, amateur boxing, karate, amateur MMA. In Japan, I did quite a lot of that. A little bit of judo. I suppose looking back, again, this thing of if I could have my time again, you know, I sometimes wish I'd sort of spent a bit more, gone into a bit more depth in to just either of freestyle wrestling or BJJ. But then I suppose you can't have it every way. Then I wouldn't have had the same breadth across all the different styles of competition. As far as grappling stuff that I was sort of proud of, I won the All Japan Shooto Grappling Championship in 2007, and then the East Japan Shooto Grappling Championship in 2008, so that was a while ago now. That was as a purple belt, but a very active wrestler as well at the same time. And I'm now 38, and I've never competed in any masters division stuff before, or even at black belt as a jiu-jitsu guy. So that's something I'm definitely looking forward to doing.
I was going
to
say, we're going to get you back on the mat.
I mean, a while ago, like, I mean, as I was moving into my 30s, I sort of thought, oh, it's, you know, this whole masters thing. I almost sort of hated the idea of it. And yet now I'm sort of quite grateful that it exists, because it sort of provides another avenue, you know, another sort of realm in which to sort of, you know, to have fun with jiu-jitsu. So that's something I'm kind of, I mean, once COVID, once the world, hopefully, you know, sort of puts itself back together, then that's definitely something to look forward to.
What are your thoughts on, like, preparing for a competition?
Mm.
How to, especially preparing for a competition before, and then on the day?
Oh, well, I mean, preparing for competition before, I mean, well, there's both my thoughts and my experiences. I of course, like, consistency, not overtraining, you know, a lot of common sense stuff. Enjoying it. Even, you know, I remember I was preparing for the British Wrestling Championships in 2006, and it had been a really hard training stretch, and I went out in the first round, having had quite a close match, and then went back to live in Canada when I was 24 and joined Toronto University Wrestling Club, spent about 6 months with them, and just had an incredibly good, happy, positive training run with them, where then I got a silver medal in a Toronto Open a few months after that. And the point being, that was straight off the back of training hard for the British Championship. And so the point being of, like, the positive thing to grasp about competition is, you train really hard for something, it doesn't go your way, that preparation in itself is a huge achievement. Giving yourself that focus of having something to aim for. Like, sure, some people aren't temperamentally sort of drawn to competing, and that's fine, but they're missing out in the sense that they don't quite have that structure of focus to their training. What I mean is, you know, if this is ultimately about sort of self-improvement and the sort of personal journey, they're missing out on quite a dynamic means of improving their game that competition provides. And so for myself, like, all I remember, I was on the Oxford boxing team, which, you know, so these posh boys boxing, ha ha ha, but, like, it was quite a serious program, and pretty hard training, and I won my match against, it was called, unfortunate name, it was Town and Gown, so we were the gown against the town. And I won that fight. It was against...
That's the most Oxford thing.
Exactly. It was called Town and Gown. So we fought the army and we all got smashed up. Apart from me, I won my fight against some dude from the army, and, you know, it was fun. I was at the Oxford Union. And then a few weeks later, then we had the big one against Cambridge, and I came up against this guy called Jim Coke, who was just like this very experienced boxer from Cambridge, and he just destroyed me. But then I took that momentum of having done all these like months and months of just pure boxing training, went back to my jiu-jitsu, and just a few weeks later fought a big, at the time, this is 2002, fought a guy called Paul Jenkins, who was this very active fighter on the British MMA scene. Great guy from Wales, very prolific fighter, and fought him and won that match. But again, on the basis of having done all that preparation for the, you know, for having taken that loss and turning it into a positive. So I'm saying the point is, you know, another cliche of like, you know, you win or learn, but that as in win or lose, but like losing being learning. But, you know, provided you don't get sort of badly traumatized or sort of hurt, which yeah. isn't impossible in combat sports. So let's hope not. To just really to sort of have the mindfulness to turn that experience into positive momentum for the next challenge, whatever it might be. The other thing, just looking back on my own experience, especially from the MMA, is which I wish I sort of had more coaching or better coaching to just really control the mental side of the game, because like there were fights I won through being just extremely like mindlessly aggressive, and then also fights I lost because of the same thing. And looking back on it, or just watching other good fighters nowadays, it's the importance of controlling your emotions. And you look at, you know, some people are very hyped up and they're very aggressive and so on, but that Cus D'Amato quote about, you know, like aggression or anger being a fire, and you know, you can use it in a controlled manner, but losing control of your emotions is just the worst. But I at the time I was aware of that as a sort of as an idea, as something people say, but I didn't grasp the meaning of it, and I kept making the same mistake again. So the advice I could give to other people, it's to sort of learn quicker than I was able to about controlling your emotions.
You know, a conversation that I still have, like, kind of like bumping heads a lot of times, mostly with my friends who are untrained, where it's just like bro science all over the place, is what is actually, like, if someone wants to learn how to defend themselves, where is the best place to start? Someone would say, oh, it's jiu-jitsu because the fight always ends on the ground. Then someone's like, no, karate, because you got to be able to jump and to run. It's like, it's just like madness. Yeah. And it's just like screams from everywhere.
What do you think? What defend themselves? I mean, like I suppose you could put that also sort of like handle yourself physically in a fight. I'd really say, even though, you know, my I'm very sort of biased towards jiu-jitsu and love jiu-jitsu, I'd say, as far as like if I had a friend or a nephew or a cousin or someone who for whatever reason like urgently wanted to, you know, to aside from embracing the kind of, you know, the lifestyle and the fun and the game, the, you know, all the other positives about whichever combat sport you happen to choose, if someone wanted to just get better at fighting, I'd really just say you could literally just take your pick of anything between, you know, it's having that, what in the straight blast gym they talk about aliveness. You could take your pick of Western boxing, Muay Thai, like judo, once you get past all the sort of the stuff, you know, that you could, there's a lot in judo that you have to learn first before you get to the sort of the good stuff, wrestling, jiu-jitsu, just any of the primary styles, I think. You could even go straight into just like learning straight MMA. Some guys have done that very successfully, coming from like a rugby background, or, you know, like a kind of rough athletic background. But I'd urge people to pick a single style. I think it's unfortunate not to get the benefit of that depth. That said, if you, I think it's also a shame, at, you know, a point I was making before about how stand-up is really important to jiu-jitsu. It's a shame to if you just supposing hypothetically you went in straight off the bat and became, you know, like a Berimbolo expert jiu-jitsu guy. You know, that's great, but it's a real shame not to be able to, you know, because you're not, you really shouldn't be doing that in any like real life situation. You just don't, for whatever reason. hate to disappoint you, but you know, so yeah, I'd say if you were doing the jiu-jitsu, then you know, like you'd want some, you know, to learn some wrestling to go with it. Yeah.
No, that's something I still haven't found on a YouTube. One of my YouTube escapades, sort of like street fight Berimbolo.
It will happen. It will happen. Someone will Berimbolo someone in a street fight.
Yeah, no, there is this footage there in the States of some guys in a gas station, and it's this fight, and this the younger guy who's clearly a jiu-jitsu guy, and he's very confident with it, and he's about to get into a fight with this huge guy who's not even like the guy standing there. I don't know what the context is. And like the younger guy just starts attacking him, like to the jiu-jitsu guy's like, right, and goes in, and this big dude's just literally standing there being like, what the hell are you doing? Just like, and eventually he gets him down, but it's kind of like it's not nearly as smooth as he wanted it to be.
have you seen the one where the two guys get into a fight and they both know jiu-jitsu?
No,
amazing. Like you can immediately tell they both know jiu-jitsu, and they kind of separate and then stop. And
yeah,
like,
but
oh.
you kind of think exactly, it'd be like, oh, we, you know, like oh, we recognize each other. Yeah. Let's step back from the abyss. Step back
nice
from the precipice.
Like, so where do you train?
Yeah, exactly. Can you imagine halfway through? What belt are you?
Yeah. Top being nice to each other. Yeah. That's great top pressure.
Wow.
I'm going to stop coaching each other.
And like after, how long have you been training for altogether?
In
jiu-jitsu.
Oh, with the thing about my jiu-jitsu is that because of periods spent focusing on MMA or wrestling, like all the time I was in Japan, I was mostly based at a club called Wajitsu Keishukai, which is not at all a jiu-jitsu, even though some of them have like taken, there's jiu-jitsu offshoots that have come out of it. That was really a sort of MMA focus with guys who are mainly ex-judoka, and they did lots of stand-up and ground. It ended up just being a lot of like no-gi grappling, but not formally jiu-jitsu. So it's sort of like being in jiu-jitsu without formally doing jiu-jitsu, if that makes sense. And that was for a few years. So hard to add it up altogether. I mean, my first encounter with jiu-jitsu, I guess, was, yeah, as I said, was when I was 13, so 38 now. So, yeah, 25 years. Wow.
And how long have you been a black belt?
Not that long. 3 years. A little over 3 years. So, but I mean, I got my purple belt when I was 21. So, I mean, so yeah, from like white to purple, that was like, I guess, so my progress through the ranks was, I suppose, fairly inconsistent, but while still being consistently involved in grappling and MMA and wrestling and so on. So
yeah.
No, which I'm, but again, I think I suppose I'm happy with having had like quite broad exposure.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, some people
different styles of grappling.
They also, just want to get as quick as possible, don't they?
Also, where I went to university, they at the time they didn't have any jiu-jitsu there at all, but they had judo. So I got into judo there and got, you know, deep into just doing straight judo and boxing. So all the time at uni was like no jiu-jitsu at all, but still trying to, you know, stay involved in combat sports. And then
so this is kind of interesting. So you're a black belt in jiu-jitsu, you're a black belt in judo as well.
Yes.
And
karate.
So
three black belts.
Yeah. Although recently I've taken this I've not had any involvement in karate since, you know, that was like a childhood, you know, which is not uncommon, like starting karate at 5 in Canada and then continuing it. Like my mum, she put me back into it she put me into karate 3 separate times, the third time of which stuck, and I carried on and started to really fall in love with it back then. And then once I sort of caught the jiu-jitsu bug, just completely quit, or sort of like washed my hands of karate, found it kind of like stale and overly formal and kind of dull. And And yet recently, I've kind of just gone back into watching a lot of karate on YouTube, like a lot of Shotokan karate especially, because I love the sort of in and out speed of it. And also obviously Machida in the UFC. It's great. Obviously his karate is backed up with a black belt in jiu-jitsu and backed up with, you know, like having done full contact training in Muay Thai and so on. But even so, but having got all this like stuff to underpin his karate, he's then able to let his karate shine. And I mean, I've long since had no involvement in karate, but I've got a slight hankering to maybe relearn the kata, maybe, I don't know, go and
punch some boards.
Yeah. go and do some.
Have you
washing Mr. Miyagi's cars?
Yeah. Plans for any more black belts?
No. I think that would
three's enough, right?
That'd be a bit silly. Although I'd like to try some. I've always wanted to try Aikido for some reason. I've never been to a class. I've never learned it, but just because apparently it was originally conceived not as a standalone system, but as a sort of addition to people already experienced in judo and so on. So there's a sense in which it could be a sort of interesting refinement, or, you know, who knows, maybe you can start pulling wrist locks from the guard and that kind of thing. Yeah.
And so this is like pretty much like it spans about, let's say, a 30-year experience with martial arts?
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, I'm well known in, I mean, actually, well, strictly speaking, 33-year experience.
And you're 38.
Yeah. But
what do you think it's like when you look at like your life? What do you think of, like, that you've gotten the most from practicing martial arts? Like, what are, I mean, I feel like that's like a loaded question.
Yeah, I suppose you could put it the other way around. With like, what have I kind of lost the most, or how is it?
Yeah, actually, that's a good question.
From like the kind of point of view of, I don't know, of
yeah, what did you
what keeping did you... the aspidistra flying, something mm-hmm. like from the it's nothing I regret, but it's like it's definitely a sort of individualistic path of doing what the hell you want because you're interested in it, and kind of not, you know, I was the kid, like, it having come from Canada and joined a school here, and all the boys went off to play football, and I was just like, can you just let me go and practice my kata, kind of thing, like, which is, you know, so it's kind of also being the kind of misfit, oddball, you know, weirdo kind of thing, you know. And I love the fact this is a sort of martial arts specialist podcast, because we can just sort of speak about this stuff in huge detail and enjoy it and kind of like geek out. But I remember reading, I think it was this, I don't know what the context was, but one of my favorite novelists referred to, like, a martial arts bore, and I was like, oh my god, I don't ever want to be a martial arts bore, kind of thing. So this thing of, like, you know, you don't want to be like the guy, which I'm sure, looking back, and I'm like, oh shit, that's often been me, clearly, in different moments in life, like, just like some aunt or some cousin like ask you a question, you're like, great, I'm going to talk about martial arts.
Or even if they don't ask a question.
Exactly. especially then, just find a way in, but right, let's talk
about
it.
Have you heard about jiu-jitsu?
So this is the thing with any specialist area, you've got to be so careful of just like not alienating the hell out of other people who don't happen to share your same obsession or same interest in it. So yeah, it's a I love it, and I continue to. Whereas when I was younger, I was very much a sort of MMA, jiu-jitsu, only the stuff that's real, diehard, and that's still ultimately like what I like, or the only thing that I'd ever want to teach someone else. But I remember, like, a few years ago, once I'd sort of gotten past that, I was in a nightclub and going to the cloakroom, and there was this guy who was clearly like a Wing Chun Bruce Lee fanatic. He was like this sort of dude with his little black wife beater with some like Wing Chun insignia on it, and he had like a
what gave it away.
Exactly. And I was just like really, whereas in the past I'd have thought, oh, what a fool. At this point I was like, wow, that's so cool, he's passionate about his Wing Chun. So I asked him about it without talking at all about jiu-jitsu or MMA or anything like that, and just wanted to know about his involvement in Wing Chun and his training in it, and just, you know, I was there with some probably quite boring friends or something. So I just chose to chat to this guy about his Wing Chun. So I think I'm at the point of just sort of appreciating other people's appreciation for that.
We're saying it's quite mental, like, that you spent about 33 years practicing martial arts. Because, I mean, Ollie this one. He mentioned before that
I did judo for like 6 months or something like that when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah.
And then it was one of those things where you're just doing so many like different clubs as a child that you stop. And then obviously starting jiu-jitsu, you're like, my God, if only I'd have kept going. Like, if only I'd have stuck with it.
As a base, yeah.
As a just being able to throw someone, score the first 2 points, and then crack on.
Yeah. I think arguably the best ever British BJJ guy so far. I mean, that's a contentious point. Had a big background in judo, a guy called Luke Costello. Mm. I've not met, but a few of my friends competed against him, and there's great footage of him on YouTube. And he was like, his dad was a British team member in judo. And then I think he kind of transitioned from judo to BJJ in his late teens, and then just caught the bug for jiu-jitsu. But you can definitely see it in his matches. Like, he'll use a Taiyotoshi and Ochigari, you know. Yeah. very
I mean, look at Ronda Rousey, right? Like, as soon as she got in the clinch and she just went for that hip toss, she's you know, it was such good grounding.
Yeah, I mean, the gut of all my people who've stood out in my memory, people I've trained with who've really sort of influenced me, or one of them, a guy, he's still an active MMA professional in Japan, a guy called Keitaro Nakamura, and he fought a lot in the UFC, sort of 50-50 win-loss ratio, but he was a high school judo athlete, and then switched into, I think he's currently, again, partly the sort of occasionally, it's not his fault, but the sort of absurdity of grades in BJJ, he's a brown belt in BJJ, but of all the grapplers I've ever trained with in my life, I had exposure to, he's like the best pure talent of just like a sort of grappling genius. Just the sort of the things, the facility with which he'd get into certain positions again and again, and just the smoothness of it. And so he had that real background in Japanese high school judo. And then added, you know, learned his striking, which was a bit wild, and his wrestling, but you know, his groundwork, which really, really stood out.
That's quite Rick. I mean, Habib is a white belt. John Jones is a blue belt.
Yeah, I mean, so it loses its meaning, like in when you switch to that sort of context.
I usually, like at the end, we don't have a usual question that we ask. Is there anything you'd like to share or anything you'd like to say to whoever is listening? Practices jiu-jitsu, does not practice jiu-jitsu. No pressure.
Well, it's tricky because on the one hand, like, I'd love to sort of urge people who haven't tried it but are curious to try jiu-jitsu or whichever combat sport, but especially jiu-jitsu, because, you know, that's what brings us all together, and that's really the, I think, training-wise, there's for especially adults entering combat sport, like, jiu-jitsu is a great place to start, just because the availability, and now the standard of coaching is just incredibly good, to at least give it a try. On the other hand, going back to that point about like that in which you're sort of intrinsically interested, it's like, I'm sure if I tried and played like badminton or something long enough, or even cricket, maybe I'll start to enjoy it or get good at it, but I'm just not interested in it. So at the same time, if you're not interested in it, then you know, I'd also say like, don't, there's a lot of other people who've sort of been interested, but then they try and they don't really stick with it, and that's fine. I see that, because if it doesn't really grab you, then but yeah, to definitely give it a try, for sure, at least. Also try the Chinese board game Go, which has been my undying obsession for the last 5 years. Yeah, completely total non sequitur, you know, but like, you think of chess, that's always been a sort of another combat sports cliche of you know, checkmate and various chess insignia and chess cliches, a bit like, oh yeah, he played it like a chess match and so on and so forth. If you're the sort of if you have the sort of mind that enjoys the intricacies of jiu-jitsu, then definitely, you know, try playing the game of chess or the game of Go, which I only, you know, discovered like 5 years ago, and I sort of play it every single day. That's definitely worth a look. It's incredibly fun, and it's there's a lot of parallels with the mat, I think, which get beyond just the sort of, you know, the sort of the you know, ideas about strategy, this, that, and the other. There's a lot to be learned from it.
Actually, I have two more questions.
Yeah, please.
You know, like, one is, what do you think are, like, the major misconceptions that, let's say, when you hear other teachers or coaches teaching their students, deep down, you can feel yourself cringing, like, oh, no, not again. Like, you feel like, ah, that's not a go-to.
Yeah, well, I mean, just in specifics, two things. One is, I guess, like, teaching complete beginners, like, lapel guard, for example, or just, like, really specific spider guard kind of stuff, when they haven't got the pre-existing, like, basics, or just idea, being able to, of course, jiu-jitsu is all made up of these separate techniques, but you need the sort of broad idea behind what the guard is, i.e. a position from which you stop yourself being dominated, i.e. by having your guard pass, and a position from which you either achieve a sweep or a submission. So going, like, people learning things without having a sort of decent overview, that's one thing. The other thing I hate to see, frankly, because it's just a waste of time, and it's a waste of an opportunity to improve skill through drilling and repetition, is when people do incredibly tough warm-ups at the beginning, where they could be doing their strength and conditioning separately on their own. That's time spent. If you're by yourself, you go do your hill sprints, do your jogging, your weights, your calisthenics by yourself. You know, you do that in your own time. When you're with other people in a jiu-jitsu context, the best training I've had have been at clubs, some in Canada and London, and Japan, where you turn up, you literally stretch for a little bit, you raise your body temperature a bit, and then you get into repeating technique, whatever the technique you're either told to do or you choose to do, because that time is precious, you know, especially people working life, student life, etc. Time is valuable, and it should be used to polish the skill, whether through specific training, drilling, or sparring. So to use time intelligently, to develop skill rather than just, like, beasting people, because, you know, because the naughty white belts who need punishment kind of thing. You know, like, whichever, you know, just there's a sort of, like, sort of slightly militaristic kind of mentality, which I think is just sort of, you used to get it in a lot of old school karate clubs too, and certain jiu-jitsu clubs too. I think that's just, it's just a shame, really, because it can put people off. And, well, at worst, it can put people off training, but then also they don't get the chance to improve as quickly as they could if they were, you know, repeating technique. So to use technique as a warm-up is a good thing.
I like, the question I had is based on, like, something I was talking about. I don't know if it was with you, Ali, like, sort of, like, you know, like, how the Danaher Death Squad guys and so on, how, like, some of them don't even have, like, 10 years worth of experience.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And then but they've
advanced so fast, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of that's down to the sort of the intelligence or the fresh approach taken by John Danaher in terms of how he sees ways of expediting the training of his athletes.
I was wondering if you had someone comes to you and they say, we're going to give you $5 million.
Right. Thank you.
But
where's this going?
You got to get this white belt who's never trained anything before.
Mm.
You're going to spend 6 months with him.
You're right, yeah.
And he's going to compete in the blue belt division.
Okay.
What do you teach this person?
Oh, well, I mean, okay. Again, I would... So I've got the... Right, so assuming from the $5 million quid or dollars or whichever...
That's after he currency. Wins.
Right. Oh, right. I thought that's like a training budget.
No.
Like I've got all the time and space.
No. They give you a space
in the world.
Bro, you get some mats on that
yeah.
side. Yeah. is this assuming he's training every day?
Free tap water for him.
Can he train on a daily basis or like 6 times a week? So he needs a
train
day
much,
to rest.
As much as you want him to train.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm in charge.
For 6 months.
Yeah.
I'm not in charge. Okay, so you need a balance between, well, different elements. Strength and conditioning, not primarily, but obviously the jiu-jitsu technique comes first. Overview of the basics, and making it fun, really. Again, going back to this point of having fun. So you come to the training with a positive attitude to engage in something that you're enjoying, that thing of like learning. I think, I'm not sure what the research is on it, but I'm sure there is some of the sort of learning when you're engaged in the activity you're doing. So making it enjoy. I mean, I'm currently teaching my 5-year-old daughter jiu-jitsu through making a game out of it. And I have ways of, I attach us. This isn't necessarily how I teach this person who's going to go from white to blue belt, but I make it really fun for her. I've ways of making her learn these jiu-jitsu positions by making a game out of it, and she has to do it again and again and again and again because she's having fun, and then in the process she's clearly picking up these, you know, ideas and these positions and stuff. So having fun with it, and I guess in that 6 month period, getting a balance between obviously getting an overview, learning an overview of as much as you can learn in the 6 month, but also identifying how he might actually go about winning, which means like finding things that he does well, or which, you know, maybe even though someone would say, oh, white to blue belt, it's not the time to develop your game. It's not the time to develop a specific, you know, expression of your style. But seeing as we're trying to get the guy as good as possible in that period, you know, it would still help to have some conception of your A game. I mean, like you're going to be making choices between, am I more of a, you know, a kind of closed guard sweep kind of guy, or am I wanting to try and find an X guard position? Like, there comes a point where I think taking the initiative in a combat sport setting is only possible on the assumption that you start identifying kind of strategic routes, which means, you know, at the outset, not so much at the outset, because you have to try and learn. You've got to keep that overview, but you also, you know, need to find a route into specific.
We've been speaking about doing a podcast on game theory for a long time,
yeah,
because there's this whole thing about that there are certain statistics, especially a white belt, that can make your game a much more strategically advantageous way of playing it. Basically, don't go for triangle chokes from the
because you have your guard passed
exactly. If you basically don't submit from the bottom at white belt, unless it is a like a cross collar choke or something.
Interesting.
Basically, interesting. Yeah, and they did. I think there's one guy who's doing this huge study on it at the moment, and he was like, the saying be first, like whoever scores first, statistically,
right,
you're more likely to win your match. But this is at white belt. Apparently, it gets really confusing.
Yeah, no, no. I've heard a lot about game theory. I don't, and other than my own love of like chess and playing Go, and then like treating jiu-jitsu and wrestling like a game, and you see certain parallels between the two, and enjoying it as, you know, enjoying these things as games, and then the sort of feedback loop of it, you know, you then being able to polish your skills in the process. I think it's definitely, there's so much to be learned about, or so much that we don't yet know, you know, ways in which things can be improved.
Yeah, and I think it might get harder to calculate at higher belts, because I think that's like where the more talented people are.
Exactly.
And they're the guys that out of nowhere are gonna come up with some magic, and you're like, whoa, how did that happen?
Maybe the thing is almost sort of playing devil's advocate against that. I don't know if this is true, but just immediately thinking out loud of what occurs to me is, it might also be the case that by sort of focusing on winning at white belt, you might then be doing yourself a disservice further along, in the sense that, like, get your ass kicked in the process and learn a lot. Not just destroyed all the time, but sort of by kind of, you might find that, like, if you look at it as like a scene on a chart, that like if you sort of peak early, then you might then hit a plateau kind of thing, whereas sort of use the learning stage as just a real sort of, you open the parachute and let it all in, and then you sort of really start to take off.
It could also be the most level playing field.
Yeah. One thing, I mean, just through my experience of like teaching myself to play Go, which is part of the appeal of it, is just like starting as a complete beginner and learning. There's a huge, incredibly simple rules, but a huge amount of theory. So much theory that you can learn and feel yourself applying and get that sort of enjoyment of like, progress. I start off at this rank, and then after a few weeks, you're sort of going up the ranks and you're getting better and better. But then you reach a point where then it's like, let's make a real effort to learn some much more advanced cutting edge theory on like the Shin Fuseki, or these sort of ideas that the sort of new Korean players have brought to Japan. And you spend a while learning the stuff, and suddenly your level drops because you've learned all this new stuff. And it takes you back quite a few steps. And this is something to keep in mind. It's like taking, what's the expression? Like one step back for two steps forward kind of thing. And I think this can be the case also in a lot of
It's a bit like the leg lockers, right? Like if they're only leg locking, they've then got to like try something new and be less good to be good.
Exactly, yeah. That's true. It's all... So I think yeah, what ties it all together is just this... The sort of, you know, we hear a lot of these platitudes in combat sports about like, self knowledge and self improvement and this, that, and the other. But I suppose part of the appeal beyond that initial thing, which I really felt as a young kid, which was like, I wanted to be better at fighting. You know, I wanted to be better, you know, like a sort of like a kind of like a this superhero thing, or this like hyper masculine thing of like wanting to be, you know, better at like walking into a room and knowing that like I'm the best here at fighting. You know, like the longer you stay in it like that, you quickly get past that, and what stays is what remains, I think, is in whichever field it might be, just that appreciation of sort of self-betterment through effort, consistency, discipline, blah blah blah.
That's great. Quite interesting. Like, for example, I think last year I decided I'm going to focus only on half guard.
Right, yeah.
And my whole idea was the 80-20, about like 80% of the results come from 20% of things, usually. Like, sort of like, it's like...
Okay, I've heard that expression, but I don't
know. Yeah, it's like a Pareto principle. And I was like, yeah, let me try to do this.
Yeah.
And worst case scenario... I will have to learn how to recover half guard. So even if I'm in open guard and so on.
Right. It's not too far away, the position you can get back to it.
But now I find like I've reached a plateau where it's like, my training partners know everything I'm going to do from half guard. And it's just like, and even passing has been like, okay, now I might need to get better at passing.
Yeah, no, right? I mean, that's
so
interesting. There was a guy... on the British scene, he was known as being a real half guard specialist, and I think it's sort of a double edged sword in that it kind of could take him really far up to a certain point, but then it's also can be slightly self limiting. Or Keenan Cornelius was also talking about the sort of eight layers of guard retention and why he personally doesn't favor going straight to half guard, because it's further down in the layers, which means even though you can get back to the half guard, the half guard's also sort of that much closer to being passed kind of thing, versus starting on a kind of like further out guard layer, which means you can then like fall back down to the half guard. But I suppose, yeah, that's quite a technical thing. The cool thing also about the half guard is how it connects very much back to specifically to single leg takedowns in wrestling. So a lot of the sweeps from half guard, once you get up to a certain point of having got off your back and onto your knees, it's then a point at which like a lot of like the limp arm, for example, is worth look on YouTube. That I was explaining this to Nero the other week, actually, about
you explained this to me,
about the limp arm position.
I remember in January,
which is straight wrestling, but it's fully applicable to half guard. So again this is how like the specifics of wrestling come in to really really help in the jiu-jitsu.
Cool.
Yeah.
On that note...
Well, thank you for joining, man. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thanks, guys. Yeah.
I feel disappointed for the 5 million. I think you'd look to the guy, you know, it's better if you grow over time. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Excellent. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, man.